This is the Kevin Simpson Show. Expert insight and analysis from the industry's top investment professionals. If you'd like a deeper understanding of today's markets, this is the show for you.
Thanks, everyone, for joining our show today. We're delighted and so lucky to have a good friend, Jackie DeAngelis, on our show today. Full disclosure, Jackie was nice enough to have me on her show last month, and everyone at Capital Wealth Planning are huge, huge fans. So we are humbled by your presence and certainly thrilled that you could take a few minutes today to join our show. As always, Jay Coulter, the admittable host, sidekick, right-hand man who keeps us on track. Thanks, Jay, for joining us as well. And if it's okay, I'm going to dive right in. I mean, I'm just so psyched to have Jackie here. And I know, Jackie, you're on Fox Business now, and prior to that, you were on CNBC. But I would love to hear the story as to how you got into the profession, how you joined CNBC, maybe what that interview was like. You know, how did you get started?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you both for having me. I'm so excited to be here to be able to sort of candidly chat with you guys today. My story is an interesting story. I never thought that I would be a journalist or a financial journalist for that matter. I always was on a path to be my house. It was you could be a doctor or you can be a lawyer. And I sort of chose to be a lawyer. And I always thought that that was what I was going to do. Ultimately, it is one of the things that I've achieved and accomplished, but it wasn't my career path. So essentially what happened to me was right when I was in college, it was sort of 99, 2000, the dot-com boom, and everybody wanted to work on Wall Street and they all wanted to go to investment banks. And I started interviewing for these things and I would get to the last round and then I would, you know, not be able to sort of make it into the end zone until ultimately I ended up landing a job at a buy side firm at Oaktree Capital, working in their emerging markets group. It ended up being an amazing opportunity for me. I did all my internships there. They hired me out of school and that was how I got my education in finance. It sort of was a real world experience. They taught me from the ground up. Wasn't something that I learned in school. And I loved it. I loved it, but I also thought there was more for me out there and I just wasn't sure, you know, what direction I was going to take it in. So that's when I left the firm to go to law school. I got my law degree or was working on my law degree, pardon me, when I got called into CNBC. And there was this madman called Jim Cramer. He had just launched a show and he needed somebody who had Wall Street experience to do some, research for him, research writing, that kind of thing, part-time. So I thought that would be a great way to like earn some money while I'm going to law school. And I ended up loving it. I fell in love with TV. I fell in love with financial journalism. And I made that my full-time job and started going to law school at night until I finished my degree. Long story short there, I ended up, you know, trying all of these different channels and avenues. I worked in development. We created shows from the ground up. And I had so much of a wealth of experience that I kind of felt like an interesting part of the development process for me would be, I do all the research. I do all the homework. Can I get up there and have the conversation myself? And that was something that I slowly worked on. But as you know, it's not so easy to always transition into this, into broadcasting on the air. So there was an opportunity in our London bureau to go abroad to the Middle East because they were launching something there and they needed a reporter. And that was the job that I went for. And they hired me and I moved and parachuted into Bahrain of all places. 6 months before the Arab Spring happened. Obviously, we didn't know that was going to happen, but that became a huge story. And it was really my first break because there was nobody else on the island at the time when there was, you know, a long period of chaos there. And that was kind of what started it all. They ended up bringing me home because it was too dangerous to stay. And I went back to the mothership and sort of, you know, started just working my way up the ladder on the air this time. And that's how we ended up here.
Well, you're clearly the smartest person out of the three of us.
And I don't think so.
and I don't know if, Jay, I don't know if you are privy to Jackie's lingual skills, but I mean, she speaks three languages and I think that is one of the coolest things. But to be there during that time, was it scary? Were you able to communicate effectively? What was it like? How were you as an American there able to, and a woman, able to get through that without, get through that in one piece?
Yeah. So my language skills are Mandarin and Farsi. So I had the Farsi on my side when I was there, but believe it or not, you didn't need any other languages, even Arabic. Everybody spoke English. So I was pretty much able to communicate and travel around the region without, you know, any difficulty. And in Bahrain specifically, women were treated, you know, very well. You didn't have to walk around covered up. It was one of the more liberal places to live. But it was an amazing experience. And it comes into my, you know, journalism, my reporting today, because look at what's happening in Afghanistan right now. Living through a movement, although I'm not comparing them, they were totally different scenarios, but a very tense movement roughly 10 or 11 years ago compared to what's happening there today. It's just, it gives you a little sense, having been on the ground, of what it could be like. And it's a very dangerous part of the world, but geopolitics now more than ever impact our markets as well. And so I think that that's really important part of the storytelling. And I'll take this one step further and tell you the Mandarin is from a stint that I did in China, where I lived in Beijing. China's become a huge part of the story too. And having that experience on the ground and understanding culture and how the dynamics of Chinese politics really works helps me do my job today.
You know, Jackie, what I find interesting is that transition you made from doing research, understanding the investment industry, to reporting on it on a much smaller level. I have found myself doing that as well. And part of what I do is help folks like Kevin co-host shows. And one of the hardest things is preparing for interviews. You've interviewed Timothy Geithner, Bill Clinton, Warren Buffett, and hosted a town hall with Barack Obama. Who is the most difficult interview you've had to prepare for and why?
Wow, that's a very interesting question. I'm going to start backtrack by saying one of the reasons I think I actually was very well suited for journalism was because when I was at the hedge fund, what we were doing essentially was the same thing. We were fact finding. It was emerging markets. It was companies that people didn't invest in or know that much about. So we would go visit and create relationships with these management teams. We had to ask them questions. Of course, we would look at the books and we would look at the balance sheet, but you wanted to see where the growth was going to be if you bought into their story. And it's so funny because as my mentor at the fund was teaching me how to do that, I realize now in my later life, that's pretty much what we do to a certain extent every day, maybe not with the end goal of investing in a company, but understanding, you know, the different stories that are out there. Having said that, the most difficult interview isn't a Bill Clinton or a Barack Obama. Of course, I mean, these people are brilliant. And so you do your homework and you do your research and you make sure that the questions are right and that you're ready. But I think some of my most difficult interviews go back to those management teams when they're trying to get you to invest early on and put in, you know, millions of dollars into a venture that nobody else has, you know, endorsed. Those are the hard interviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And I can see how that skill set transferred into what you're doing right now with Fox Business News.
Yeah, it's been amazing. So I've roughly been doing this for, I would say, 15 years now. And what I wanted to do when I left CNBC, it was just such a wonderful place to get the fundamentals and the skill set down. But I wanted to build on that and diversify a little bit because at that time I was covering oil and commodities, and I wanted to broaden out to the larger markets and also have conversations about politics and how that impacts the market and, you know, what the future is. And so I've been able to do that at Fox Business. Specifically, you know, they've given me a larger runway to be able to have those conversations, which I'm grateful for.
We see you on Fox Business all day, every day, all across the network. Is there a big difference between the two, between Fox Business and CNBC? Certainly being respectful of both, but we love seeing you on Fox Business for sure.
Yeah, of course. Listen, you know, I mean, they're two different networks and they're run different ways and some of the objectives are probably different in how they use their talent. So, you know, I've just found that it's a great fit for me here in terms of the conversations that I want to have, the conversations that are organic to me. And also, you know, my managers have sort of tapped into some of the questions you're asking about my background and what makes me unique, what perspective I have as a journalist. And so all of a sudden, when you start to peel back those layers, you realize I can talk a lot more than just commodities, bringing all of these unique lenses to my reporting and to the conversation.
So let's use that as a great pivot. Let's talk about Afghanistan. A couple of days ago on Fox Business News, you reported about the economic implications of the Taliban sitting on what an estimated $1 trillion worth of metals and minerals. What do we need to be thinking about as it relates to that transition in that part of the world?
Well, obviously, the first thing I would say before we even get to the metals and the minerals would be the stability in the region. Again, having lived there and understanding the players and the dynamics, you know, obviously, Iran is one of the big bad actors. It's got all of its proxies in different countries sort of wreaking havoc to a certain extent. I mean, that's their goal, is not to have stability. That's the way that regime continues to stay in power. The linchpins that you have, the American allies, for example, the UAE and Saudi Arabia, you know, all wonderful, but don't necessarily marshal the same kind of power. And so when you're seeing what's happening in Afghanistan with the Taliban right now, it concerns me greatly, because I think about overall stability in the region and the ability for these terror organizations to essentially, you know, putting it mildly, cause a lot of trouble and a lot of disturbance. Ultimately, there's a human element to that. So, of course, we're worried about that. But the second piece of it is the economic implications, right? Obviously, a lot of energy still comes out of that region, very important. And it just, you know, we've seen it before when there's turmoil in the Middle East. And first and foremost, though, you worry about terrorism, as we're going into the anniversary of 9/11. And you know, part of the reason that I think this administration wanted to pull out was to celebrate that anniversary. In a way, it's sort of backfired on them. But you wonder, you know, we were there and we stabilized the region to an extent and were able to ward off terrorism for 20 years. What happens now? And that isn't local in that region. As you can see, those tentacles can spread across the world.
And as a follow-up question to that, you also did a piece with a couple of co-authors, and I want to get their names correct. It was Dan Blakely and Tom Ametta, who are co-authors of The 20-Year War. Mm-hmm. And listening to you ask those questions about the dangers of security's checkpoints, of being in a country at a time like we are today, I felt like your questions came from a place of experience. You know, what's your take on that, given your experience overseas?
Well, they did. And so during the Arab Spring, again, I was not dealing with the Taliban, so I don't want to overstate this in any way. But when I was in Bahrain, most of the tumult was in Egypt. You had the Muslim Brotherhood and you had all the protests, and they were essentially overthrowing their leader, Hosni Mubarak, at the time. But there was a spillover effect into Bahrain as well, which was, run by a constitutional monarchy. But there were these religious groups that were, you know, always opposing the royal court and whatnot, that were starting to have these uprisings. What ended up happening, because Bahrain is an important Saudi interest, is the Saudis came over and they essentially sort of tamped down any unrest to kind of mellow things out. They did that with force initially before, you know, people sort of realized how serious they were, and then it died down. But one of the ways that they secured the island was with these checkpoints. And that was the period where my company realized it was very dangerous for me to be there, and they wanted to evacuate us. So in the process of the evacuation, we had to go through these checkpoints. And it's very intimidating and it's very scary. And people are standing there with their faces covered in a sandstorm, essentially. This was my experience. And they take your passports and they're going through your car, and you realize they have weapons, and you realize that you're at the mercy of this person, whatever they want to do or whatever they don't want to do. If they want to be benevolent and let you go, then that's fine. And if they don't and they want to cause a problem for you, then it's going to be a separate issue. So the fear and the terror, I remember those moments and what it felt like. So I can only imagine, to magnify that on a crazy scale, because, you know, when I was there, a Saudi army official was never going to do anything to somebody with an American passport. I always knew that in the back of my mind. But you don't know that with the Taliban. I mean, we are a country that says we don't negotiate with terrorists, and there's a reason for that. And now we're in a situation where we don't even have an accurate number of how many of our people are left there, how many of them will be stranded after next Tuesday's deadline, and what will happen. The other thing is, I think about what happened in Iran in 1979, when, you know, the Shah was overthrown, essentially, and you had this, you know, militant Islamic regime come in, and we had the hostage crisis. These situations are just, they're terrifying, and they're ordeals, they're international ordeals. And it's just, I hope that's not how this plays out, but it's difficult to see where it's going, given the path that we're on at the moment.
It's hard to see a positive outcome, right? I mean, you hope for it, but it's difficult to see that path.
You hope for it. And then you have an administration who unfortunately is giving us so many, let's put it this way, they're conveying factual inaccuracies, right? With regards to how many people are still there, how difficult it is to evacuate. From our reporting on the ground, we understand that it's been very challenging and that people don't feel like they have any support. And so, what's going to happen? The Taliban has essentially forced our arm in setting this deadline. What's going to happen when they decide they don't want to play ball anymore?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Jackie, I could talk to you about this for hours. We only have a limited amount of time, and I'd love to pivot to some of the issues we're looking at around the markets. When Kevin and I were preparing for this interview, because of your experience in the energy markets, we'd love to get your take on where you see energy markets today, and more specifically, what financial advisors and portfolio managers should be paying attention to in the energy markets.
Well, I think what you have to pay attention to is the instability in the Middle East, because again, we're transitioning and the pendulum is swinging back where we will become more reliant on foreign oil. Unfortunately, we had created a situation where through the shale boom, through fracking, through unlocking all these hidden resources, which we have so many, and getting more out of the wells that we had already drilled, we were producing massive amounts of oil. Now that's come down a little bit, partially because of the pandemic, but partially because people can see the handwriting on the wall with the administration and renewable energy policy. So if you start to see those production numbers come down even more and we become less, U.S. sort of centric, yet less U.S. independent on our energy production, we rely more on foreign oil, you can expect the prices to go up. Part of the reason they're going up now is pandemic demand, but that's not the only reason. Part of it is this geopolitical environment as well. And part of it is it's domestic U.S. politics, 100%.
Excellent. So it all kind of ties together a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Easy follow-up question there is around inflation. And everybody has an opinion. Everybody has numbers that they like to source. As a financial reporter, what inflation metrics do you think people should look at?
Oh, that's a great question. Believe it or not, I'm not going to point you to market metrics. I don't think market metrics actually are an accurate indication, because if you left it up to the Fed, they would tell you that core CPI strips out food and energy, and therefore we really don't have a lot of inflation. But if you're on the ground and you're actually feeling it and paying for things, you know that's not true. So this is where my sort of experience as a consumer, as a person, as a journalist, all comes into play together. And I say, I've seen the prices in New York City for essential items go up anywhere from, let's say 25 to 35%. That's substantial. It's palpable, and it's going to have an impact, because wages, while they're rising, are certainly not rising as fast. On top of that, you look at the situation we're here in the city, for example, trying to recover post-pandemic with all the challenges that we have, with all the money that we spent, with the crime rates. And you wonder how this economy is going to recover when prices are moving up so quickly. So I take that little microcosm and think about the rest of the country and the impact that this is going to have. And I think that people are largely underestimating the negative impact of inflation right now.
Kevin, we've asked every guest their opinion on inflation since you started this show, and your opinion has evolved slightly over time. What are you thinking today as a portfolio manager in terms of how inflation should be viewed?
Well, I love Jackie's analogy of using the eyeball test for inflation, because if we listen to the Fed, we would know that it's transitory and it's going to go away. When in reality, that's not the case. You can't see consumer goods going up 20%. And even to the extent that wages are going up, it's not something you take back. Like, oh, the inflation is gone, so now we're going to cut your wages. Like, that's not the reality.
We raise our price at this restaurant. Now we're going to cut our prices 20%. I've never seen that happen in my life. If you see it, let me know.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. Right. So we're the victims of our own creation here with respect to prices. And that's not to say that it's our fault. We didn't create the COVID-19 virus. We didn't create a global pandemic, but how you deal with it moving forward is you need a Fed to take some action. We may get some news this week out of Jackson Hole. I doubt it, but the probability is we'll start to see policy in the future that will begin tapering, and then maybe eventually we'll see interest rates go up down the road. But the fear is that the Fed takes too little action and isn't taking it seriously enough. And that's what I'm scared of right now.
Yeah, I am too. And I'll just add to that and say, if they're not taking it seriously enough, there will be a point right now, post-pandemic, everybody will spend more, they'll pay more because we've been cooped up, right? But at a certain point, it will be a chilling effect on the economy where people won't be able to afford to do things. And they'll start making decisions and making cuts and trying to manage budgets better. The flip side to this, it was a conversation I had this morning where someone said, well, after stimulus, people will be getting back to work. They'll be getting their paychecks. And consumers have saved a lot of money during this time. Maybe they'll spend it. Maybe they will, but their buying power will be substantially less.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. So two more topics, if you have time, Jackie. First is around something comes up every show as well, Bitcoin and digital assets. And you know what we are finding is that the noise around these is getting louder and louder. The legitimacy of these as investable assets seems to be becoming institutionalized. So we'd love to get every guest's opinion. What are your thoughts on, as an investment, Bitcoin and digital assets?
I mean, I am more of the Warren Buffett school of investing. If you don't really understand something, you shouldn't be investing in it. I understand Coca-Cola. I get, whatever. I get Ford cars. And so I can understand those companies and their business models. I don't really still feel, and I probably have better knowledge than most, that I really understand cryptocurrencies enough to make them a part of my portfolio. I would say, diversify, have a little piece of it, you know, something that's not going to break your bank if it doesn't work out. But all of a sudden, if these things really take off, then you had a toe in the water.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Kevin, have your thoughts around digital assets changed?
Well, similar to Jackie's response, as a portfolio manager, I pay attention to it, but I profess to be far, far from an expert. I was surprised when Palantir decided that they would put $50 million into gold bars as a hedge against inflation, as opposed to looking at something like Bitcoin. You'd think a company like that would be proactive with the crypto case. It didn't seem to set it back at all. I mean, I know the prices of digital assets continued to increase even in the wake of that news. Maybe it was because Coinbase talked about adding $500 million to cryptocurrency. So maybe the scale says, well, $500 million by Coinbase is bigger than $50 million from Palantir. But I thought it was a hit to the legitimacy, or at least to the run rate of this as a burgeoning asset class. So like Jackie, we'll both keep an eye on it, but not something that we'll be putting clients' assets in at this time.
All right. Last topic is around the infrastructure bill. Jackie, you recently had Rep. James Comer from Kentucky on. He was saying that he did not feel that the bill was good for rural America.
Well, overall, we can make the argument that something President Trump didn't get to was infrastructure, and that the trillion, 1.2 trillion that we're talking about, that was bipartisan, is enough to cover the hard infrastructure needs. There was more in that bill than just hard infrastructure. So I feel like the left got some of their wish list included in that as well. But, you know, OK, fine. Having said that, I think given the amount of spending that we've done as a country to get out of the pandemic, it's probably enough at this point. I'm very concerned about that $3.5 trillion human infrastructure package. You know, we just had a conversation about inflation. One of the ways to, to worsen the inflation situation is to continue to spend in this way. And so, I would say I would support or understand the passage of the $1 trillion, but $4.5 trillion is just, it's substantial and it will hurt the country.
Kevin, what's your take as a portfolio manager?
I think Jack and I are of like minds on pretty much every question you've asked, Jay, but old fashioned real stimulus is an investment. And you're talking about a five-year period of this roads, bridges, waterways, even broadband, which maybe is an old-fashioned infrastructure, but it's real infrastructure. That's an investment. It's not a handout. So I think anything along those lines is something that we would all support. It was bipartisan. Anything short of that, when you talk about another $3 trillion, it's not infrastructure. It's not. So I hope we have some fiscal responsibility as a country as we think through this next phase.
Excellent. Jackie, we really appreciate you coming on. For viewers and listeners, if you're interested in signing up for Kevin's Monday Morning Observations newsletter, please visit cwpnewsletter.com. That's cwpnewsletter.com.
Way more importantly, watch Jackie on Fox Business. She's far better than I am.
So great to see you guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jackie. Thanks, Jay. Bye, everybody.
This message does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to purchase securities through CWP Advisory Services. Investments are not guaranteed and involves risk of loss. The views and opinions expressed in this message are those of investment professionals made at the time this content was recorded, are not necessarily the views and opinions of CWP, and may change in time without notification. For additional information about CWP, visit CWP's or the SEC's website for a copy of our ADV disclosure brochure and Form CRS.